Well, hi, everybody. This is Mark Chaffardini with Go See Talk. Welcome back to the podcast. Today, we're Crane kicking it into high gear with half of the composing badasses who has scored Cobra Kai. Zach Robinson, welcome to the show. How are you doing today?
I am excellent on this Tuesday morning. How about you, Mark?
Oh, I'm doing fantastic. Or let's use some 80s vernacular. I'm dope. I'm dope, Zach.
Your boss today? That's cool.
It's feeling fresh.
Rad.
Well, cool, man. I really have to commend you on the show and what you and Leo have done to it. However, can you give us some backstory on the poster that's behind you?
Oh, yeah. Well, you can't see it for the podcast people, but I'm sitting, I've got this poster in my room, and it's like kind of movie poster size, and it is our album cover for the first season with amazing album art by Chrome and Lightning, who's big in the synthwave community and also did my DAD album art, which we'll talk about probably. But yeah, he did this, and then it's signed by the showrunners, just like a fun message. It's from our first season. It was pre-Netflix era.
Oh, yeah, back
before it took off.
When it was a YouTube original, I think, right?
Yeah, yeah.
Well, speaking of, I mean, I'm thrilled to be speaking to you, but I want to give a confession time. My brother, we both grew up in the 80s. He told me, he said, Mark, you got to watch this show. And some of my friends who were a little older, they were even more deep-seated in the 80s. They were like, man, check out the trailer. And I was so apprehensive. It came right after on like, Ralph Macchio did a Funny or Die video called Wax On,
I remember that.
Off.
Uh-huh.
And part of me was like, no, I don't know where this is going to go. And my brother was like prodding me and chiming, got to watch it. And then 2 years later, I'm like, oh my God, you were right. You were right. So I'm a little late to the game, but it's awesome.
You're not alone. Most people, I think, felt the same way. The barrier to entry on YouTube was just a lot. And, look, it really just like we all knew it was a good show. We all loved working on it and we knew it was special. And the move to Netflix just made it so many more people could see it. And I don't blame them. I don't blame, you know, I mean, I am keeping like an Arya Stark list of everyone that tells me they didn't watch it, but like, I don't blame you for not watching it.
And you know, I think I've also been burned in the past. You know, you have sequel after sequel, and just the more you try to dive into the mythology or the fan base, whatever it is, you always have diminishing returns. And I just didn't want this to happen to Karate Kid, but man, I'm so glad I was wrong.
Well, yeah, it's they did something special. Like there's nothing else like it, truly. And I hope that it brings other like properties. I hope people treat other properties the same way that they, with the respect and with the care and with the love that went into Cobra Kai. Because John, Josh, and Hayden are literally, this is their Star Wars. They told us that in our first meeting with them, that this is a big deal to them. And I remember even like they said the first trailer of the show, they had all these notes because the tone wasn't right. And they were really trying to like explain to YouTube and to the executives and everything, like, this is, you have to treat this a certain way. And they got their way and it ended up working out.
Man, that's awesome. Well, before we dive into that, before we dive into DAD, can you tell us what got you into music? Was it a face melting shredding that you heard? Was it did you see Dee Snider in concert? What got you on the road to six string samuraiing?
I think I've been really into film composing, I think, since I was probably around 13 or 14. And I mean, I loved Ennio Morricone is kind of like my ride or die. I, you know, watched all the Westerns. And I remember, it was funny, I actually just watched the Kill Bills, like over the past couple, like the quarantine times, we rewatched Kill Bills. And my girlfriend was like, this is the most Zach soundtrack I've ever heard in my life. And I actually realized that, like, I actually think around like Kill Bill, like 2003, it was kind of like when I was discovering like film music and what I was really into. And there's so much stuff on that type of soundtrack, which has Ennio Morricone, of course, and amongst others, but I was really into kind of like genre and a lot of different kind of like larger than life type of sounds. And at the same time, I started playing guitar and that. So yeah, I was kind of discovering like heavy metal and Iron Maiden and, you know, Black Sabbath and Led Zeppelin and all that stuff. And then that turned into like fusion and like jazz fusion and all that stuff. And then I ended up studying, you know, I played in bands in high school. I'm from LA. So I played in bands and played at like all the venues and stuff growing up. And then I went to Northwestern University in Chicago and studied film music. And that's also not film music. I studied composition. Sorry. And it was actually important that I did not study film music. I just studied composition. I wanted to kind of get a foundational education. But at the same time, I was also starting up, you know, writing what is now called synthwave, but it wasn't called that back then. But like, I was really into like 80s revival music or whatever, retro synth or whatever. And it was on MySpace. It was like a really big thing in like 2008 MySpace. And I remember in my dorm, like finding all of these groups like Future Cop and Miami Nights 1984 and La Matos, who I know you've interviewed, like all of those groups, pre-drive. I always like to say pre-drive and post-drive, but an Electric Youth was, you know, big on MySpace too. Anyway, but that's how I came to study. And then when I moved back to LA, I started working for a composer named Christoph Beck, who's a very prolific film composer. And he did Frozen. That was the first project that I worked on, was Frozen. And we worked on Ant-Man, Edge of Tomorrow. He actually currently just did WandaVision, which I did not work on, but I heard is awesome. And that's where I met Leo too, was at Chris's place.
Oh, okay, great. Mm-hmm. I was wondering how that connection was established.
Yeah.
So you mentioned La Matos, and I think I've heard synthwave described as Outrun. Are there some mm-hmm. other terminology that you threw around to describe your passion?
I feel like I called it like 80s inspired electronic music project for a long time. And I called it, it's something like retro electro. I remember I heard that, because electro, the term electro was actually really big in like the late kind of aughts, like Busy P and Ed Banger and Justice and like that whole squad was super big when I was like in high school going into college. So a lot of, and like Kavinsky, that's kind of where Kavinsky came out of, who's kind of the bridge from like electro into synthwave. So I remember like electro, 80s inspired, like electro was the term. And then I heard Outrun because Outrun is named after a video game, like an arcade game. I think Outrun's the coolest genre name because it just doesn't sound like any other genre name. It's very cool. Yeah. But
if it feels like you're outrunning, like you're either outrunning something or out.
Yeah. Which so much synthwave is like that. I think what I liked about the genre is that it actually is incredibly cinematic. And I like that there's so much imagery involved with it, which I think is why I connected with it so much.
So when you're putting you're taking what you learned in composition and coming up with, maybe we'll just jump into DAD right now. Mm-hmm. Was there a shopping list of things you needed to make synthwave music? Were there certain tempos? Were there layering?
That's a good question. I definitely, in terms of physical merchandise, I mean, I was a freshman in college. I didn't have any money, so I didn't, and I like wasn't working, so I didn't have, the money to buy synths or plugins. I started out in Logic, and my first DAD EP is all soft synth. It's called Supermotives, and that's from like 2009, and that's all soft synth, but I used Logic. I mean, it was a lot of sample finding in terms of like drum samples. Like I have friends who just gave me gigabytes of like drum samples, which I still have and still use today. Definitely, like, I think getting your music out there was a bit difficult. Like MySpace Music was really the kind of premier like music hosting website. And so you needed to know how to kind of like use MySpace and then kind of network on MySpace by like adding people. Bandcamp came along like 2009, and someone recommended that to me, and that's where I started hosting, and SoundCloud was around at that point too. And then in terms of like, I don't know, like I did all my own like graphic design, but I didn't know anything about, I just kind of tried to find cool 80s pictures, Google image search, and put DAD and like word art over that. I don't know. Does that answer your question? Oh, and guitars. Like, I mean, I had all my guitars. That's the one thing, okay. Is that I also like need, that was my big kind of the difference between most of the synthwave I heard was that it was mostly all synths. I didn't hear a ton of guitars. So I remember incorporating a lot of that, and I would just record right into Logic. That was a big thing for me. I had like a few pedals. I remember using this harmonizer pedal for a lot of stuff. A lot of like the harmonized guitar solos you hear on my first EP or that. So
does it have to be electronically manipulated, be that style of music? Because like you said, you know, you use a lot of guitars, but how do you fuse the things that become this genre of music?
Sure. I think I think a lot of people get bogged down with production. And a lot of people get bogged down with like, oh, I need this VST, or I need this plugin, I need this piece of hardware in order to make something. And what I think creates the best, let's say in this sense, synthwave is not the production, but is the vibe, and I think it is very easy to tell when someone kind of gets it, quote unquote, gets it. And like gets the vibe. And I can listen to a track for 5 seconds and just say like, okay, this person knows where it's at. Production does like play a big part, I think. But if someone is just like looking, and this goes for any kind of style of music, like I learned this from a composition teacher, that like you really cannot let the kind of external forces of like consumerism define your sense as a composer or a writer. And you need to first focus on like, what are you trying to communicate, and like, how do you communicate? Are there certain, in synthwave, there's certain chord progressions that evoke that type of vibe. There are certain tempi that work in synthwave. Are you making a dance track? Are you making a more kind of like Phil Collins, like kind of ambient type of track? Ambient in the sense of like In the Air Tonight or whatever. I think that's mostly what separates the really good synthwave artists from the, I mean, there's plenty of them now, because again, post-drive world, it opened up a lot. It became mainstream basically. And you get a lot of people who are kind of making the same type of synthwave that's been around. But I think the ones that really, when I find one that's like really new sounding, it generally is because the vibe is so present. It's not just the production to me.
Sure. And you know, when you mentioned Bandcamp, I found a number of artists, and I'm not going to claim that I can tell whether they're pre or post drive, but a couple that I just tend to gravitate towards are Tommy 86, Arcade Summer. Mm-hmm. There's another band called Splash. I think they're out of Israel, or cool. Something like that. And I think if it hits you, it hits you. And whether they know what they're doing or whether you know what good music is, I mean, it's all about the feeling. So that's why I love totally. Talking to composers.
And what I loved about the synth wave that was happening when I was kind of working on it was I really liked how it wasn't as dark. There's a lot of like dark wave now, I guess, right? It's kind of evolved, like part of the synthwave has kind of evolved, or there's like a sect of kind of like popular like dark industrial quasi goth, like you've got like Perturbator and like Carpenter Brut, and like they're amazing, I love them, but I did like the kind of nostalgic for an era that didn't quite exist vibe that you get from Miami Nights, other ones like Dynatron, a Future Cop I mentioned, MPM Music is like one of my all-time favorites, who I don't think hasn't made music basically in 10 years, like it was, and Mitch Murder of course, but like they all not only had amazing just music that was kind of like a little wistful, I guess that might be the right word, but they always accompanied it with like videos, and you know, there's this blogger named Uncle T-Nuck who I don't know if you know who Uncle T-Nuck is, but like he would just like take these songs and just take videos from like, you know, kind of teen high school movies from the 80s and put them, and he did one for LaMatos for How Do I Let You Know by LaMatos, which really stuck with me. Like I love that song. I love the video. And that was what I really actually connected to. There's this kind of nostalgic element that I really connect with that more than the dark industrial stuff. But I do love that too. I just think that for me, when I remember kind of like working on that, that's the stuff I really, really love.
Gotcha. Well, how long did it take to put your 2013 album together?
Supermotives was Super the first motives. One. Okay. That was an EP, yeah. And then The Construct was 2013. And that took me 4 years, probably. Like, I mean, I wasn't focusing on it because I was in school and doing other stuff. But when I got out of school is when I finished it. And it was just a kind of a culmination of years of stuff that I've been working on. I'm still pretty proud of it. I mean, it just got released on vinyl. Like
I saw over, that.
Like in May. Yeah. No, not in May. Like later than that. But yeah, I mean, that's a huge, that's cool. Like, I mean, the fact that people are still interested in it is very cool. I never thought it would be on vinyl. It's on vinyl, cassette, and CD. So I don't know what else, you know, you can do with it. But yeah, it took about 4 years.
Okay. Which tracks were you the proudest to make? And what ones were the toughest to sort of get over that hurdle?
I think proudest was Sky High, I think is my favorite, which again, actually kind of, that's the most like kind of wistful and nostalgic to me. And I wrote that in when I was in London. I lived in London for a little bit. And like, I wrote that and I just have a very nostalgic memory of writing that, in that it's kind of like a positive track. That one I love, Orion Beach is another favorite of mine, and Love Will Make You Stay is another favorite because that one has vocals. That was the only track I ever did with vocals. And I think the challenge was probably I think the challenge was just generally putting the whole album together and finding things. I had so much stuff written and stuff I had to decide to throw out. And then of course you have 8 tracks and you're like, I gotta find 2 tracks to make it 10, to make it even. That stuff is really challenging. And then I mean, I listen to a lot of it now and I'm not super happy with a lot of the production. If I could do it differently, I would some, but I am overall very proud of it. I can still listen to it without cringing, which I think a lot of artists can't do with their stuff from 8 years ago, but yeah.
Yeah, that's a tremendous accomplishment because, yeah, I've spoken to a bunch of composers and I don't think that there have been maybe more than 2 who have not balked at the idea of right. going back. And because, you know, they think of the things that they were doing at the time and, you know, whether it was well received, you know, they may go, well, I wrote that over a night because, you know, I had to give a pitch the next morning. And it's like, well, somehow it turned out to be a hit, but whatever
right.
it is.
Right. You're never planning on it if it's going to be a hit. It just happens. And like, I don't even know what metric is, you know, how you measure a hit. If it's not album sales, it definitely was not album sales for DAD, but I think it did, you know, it was a hit personally for me. Cause I think it kind of paved the way for me kind of finding my voice mm-hmm. and ultimately leading to Cobra Kai or whatever. But, and it's cool to see, you know, I feel honored that people reference it about synthwave and people like say, you know, synthwave pioneer or whatever. I think that's cool. Like, I mean, I like that that I have been doing it for a while. I think it's cool.
And when you said going back to what you said about finding your voice, can we go back to a young Zach? Can you tell us the first album you bought and maybe the first album you got from maybe an uncle or a brother who realized maybe I shouldn't be listening to this, but it's awesome.
Well, Blink-182, Enema of the State, probably. I got it on Christmas, and I think a friend got it for me. And I mean, what adolescent boy looks at that album cover and is like, what's going on? what's going on with my brain? So yeah, Enema of the State. What are like other, I don't remember quite my, I think that it was definitely my first CD that someone ever gifted to me for sure. And then in terms of like what I ended up buying, it was kind of the iTunes era. It was kind of like the Morpheus Kazaa era. So okay. I feel like I remember the first song I ever downloaded on Morpheus. I just brought this up to someone. It was Crawling in the Dark by Hoobastank.
Oh, really?
Yeah, interesting stuff, huh?
I've seen them in concert. There's no shame in Hoobastank. Yeah.
Tenacious D album was one of the first ones, or like Running with Scissors by Weird Al Yankovic was another one. I remember getting like the Led Zeppelin like box set, you know, from like my dad that had like 8 CDs in it. Pink Floyd was my also all time favorite group ever. I still like listening to Pink Floyd. Yeah, that's a I will say I do have very nostalgic memories of going to the Tower Records RIP near my house on Friday nights. It was at the Galleria, the Sherman Oaks Galleria, which is also a very 80s heavy. It is a very like 80s location. The Sherman Oaks Galleria is where they shot Valley Girl. It's where they shot Fast Times at Ridgemont High. So definitely got that in my blood. The San Fernando Valley is in my blood.
Well, yeah, I remember my cousin, who was quite a bit older than me, he was in rock bands. He gave me Motley Crue's Theater of Pain, which I listened to in probably fifth grade. And then I bought Metallica Black on cassette.
Sure.
And that's cool. And I hid both of them. There was just something like, I don't think my parents are going to be cool with this.
I feel like Metallica is better than Motley Crue in terms of the parents being upset department. I feel like Metallica doesn't like explicitly, I feel like, sing about like inappropriate shit. Whereas Motley Crue, I feel like, is inappropriate. Like a parent would like be like, oh, but maybe I'm wrong.
No, we'll go with that. Smoking in the boys' room versus Enter Sandman. Like, what?
Right.
This sounds so poetic. And then,
right.
You know, go back to
smoking. I was so lucky. My parents never felt that way. And maybe they weren't paying attention, but I think they just didn't. I think they were confident enough in my ability to, like, kind of, you know, not internalize the stuff that I heard on albums or music. And I never, I mean, we listened to, you know, Real Slim Shady or a Marshall Mathers LP or whatever in the car with my mom, like pretty young, and like Enema of the State in the car with my mom, and my dad took me to a Metallica concert when I was 12, and like,
wow,
they were always super cool about that. Yeah.
Mrs. Robinson.
Yeah. Mrs. Actually, her last name is Zax, and she would, she would tell you that Zaks. I actually have her last name as a first name, basically.
Oh, wow. Thanks for sharing.
But here's to her. and here's to my dad too, who's they were good parents. No, they were great in terms of like art and like culture.
Okay. Yeah, my parents, well, my dad let me watch The Thing and Aliens when I was 12, so I think it sets you on a trajectory, you know,
right?
That kind of music, those movies, you know, I feel better about myself. Well, again, thank you for being on the show. Why don't we talk about working with Christoph Beck a little bit, and that connection you made with Leo, and how you guys decided to, or how you guys got tapped for Cobra Kai?
Sure. Yeah, so Leo was working at Chris's before I got there. So I always like to say my first day I was an intern and I got Leo coffee, which is hilarious. And now he gets me plenty of coffees. Whenever we both want coffee, he gets me coffee. So we make that joke a lot. But Leo was working there for about a year and a half longer than I was. I showed up and we were there for a very heavy 3 years. And I say heavy, meaning Chris was kind of like Frozen kind of took him to like another level. And then post Frozen, there was a lot of work coming in and the team was really busy and it was good. I was really happy and hungry to like, you know, be there and learn a lot. And, you know, was willing to do kind of all nighters and weekends there, which I no fucking way would I do all nighters, even on my own. I hate all nighters. But I was willing to do it. And obviously just learned a lot. We were working on the biggest of the biggest. Like there's really, you know, you can't get much bigger than a Marvel movie. And we were working on not just the writing, but the kind of like clientele relationship part of the business, where like, you know, we would be in the meetings with Chris and the directors and we would see how like Chris interacted with the directors or with like giant Marvel execs or Tom Cruise or something. Like literally, like Tom Cruise came to the studio when we were doing Edge of Tomorrow. So like seeing that was really interesting. And Chris was actually very gracious in a way that a lot of other composers are not, where he was not afraid to like, he was not threatened by us. And like a lot of composers have additional writers or whoever's working for them kind of like in a closet who never see the light of day, in terms of light of day, meaning they don't get to meet the executives, the music executives from Fox and the music executives from Sony or whatever. But like, we got to do that and they know us and we still have a relationship with them. So when it was time to leave Chris's, Leo and I We actually got hired to do this show on YouTube Red. It was called YouTube Red back then. And it was a show that involved a lot of pre-production with songs. They were singing on camera. So we did about 35 song arrangements. We did the score for the show. It was called Sing It. And then we decided that, I mean, it was just a good partnership. And we didn't really work. Leo and I do our own thing too, which is really nice. That's actually something we really like about our relationship, is that we have our own types of projects that we work on, and that is different than what we do together. And Cobra Kai, we saw in the trades that there was a Karate Kid show. And I think, like you and like a lot of other people, were like, what is this show? Like, what are they doing with the Karate Kid? Like, oh, it'll probably be like the Jaden Smith movie. We have this relationship with YouTube Red. Why don't we like try to milk that and try to get on a meeting for this show? Like, who knows what it's going to be? We didn't know anything about the show. No one knew anything. It wasn't reported about Ralph Macchio or Billy Zabka being in it. So we put together a reel that had a lot of kind of the stuff we worked on at Chris's, kind of big orchestral stuff. But we also put some DAD on, and we put some other like kind of 80s stuff on there that we had done. And our agent passed it along to the creators or their producers, and we ended up getting a meeting, and we had the meeting, and 15 minutes later we got the gig. We found out we got it. And I gotta say, like, that doesn't happen. Like, and now having perspective on it too, especially like this was 2017, and being in a professional, you know, since then, like, it just doesn't happen like that anymore. Like, there, most of the reels you put together are sent into the void. They are not heard, they're not seen. The fact that we were able to get it over there and then have it connect and then get a meeting, have it connect, or like, it just is so rare. And for the creators to kind of give us the opportunity to do it, like, we didn't have any credits besides additional music credits working for Chris. Like, we didn't really have this, we didn't have like a big show. And nowadays you've got, you know, composers like Chris doing TV shows. So like, it's very, very difficult to get a TV show, especially one that's kind of a higher profile one, like an IP like Karate Kid. So kind of a long-winded story, but that's how we got it. And it's still, I like count my blessings, because it's just crazy that we got it. I still think it's crazy.
and like you said, within 15 minutes. So what was the turnaround? And did you had discussions with John and Hayden? Like, how fast did you get the ball rolling after that?
They hadn't started shooting yet, which also is rare. I think it's not, it's becoming more common to hire composers before shooting now, but it usually is kind of like while they're shooting or right afterwards. But, and that's kind of late. I think all composers should be hired before, but we got hired, and then they immediately went to Atlanta to start shooting. And then we kind of started getting cuts like a month later, maybe. And the tone, we had to kind of find out what the tone was, but part of our pitch in the meeting was that we wanted to, you know, play Johnny. We wanted, the script was so funny. That first episode of Cobra Kai is so good. And like, we needed to play the humor of Johnny. And our first kind of pitch, score wise to them, was the scene when Johnny is beating up the kids in the parking lot of the mini mart, like where he meets Miguel basically, or when he saves Miguel. And that was kind of like, we want the music there to be what Johnny hears in his head. Like, it needs to be kind of over the top. It needs to be, it's kind of inspired by like, you know, a video game version of like him playing, like, this is him being badass. And we needed, and that was our big pitch to them. And we were really nervous about like, is this the tone that they want? And sure enough, like, they were super down with it. And we had a few other back and forths in terms of like deciding what else the tone was going to be. Ace Degenerate, which is the very first piece of music you hear when Johnny wakes up, that took a few versions to get to there of like, what is this vibe that we're trying to accomplish? And then of course we have all the Daniel music, which is like Miyagi inspired, Bill Conti inspired orchestra stuff. So there's a lot of music in the show. There's a lot of perspectives to hit. There's a lot of tones, but I think we ultimately ended up in a place where we're very happy with the tone that it sets for the show.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, you bring up Bill Conti, cause he was the composer of the first three movies. Mm-hmm. What was interesting is that you don't dip too deep into that well, kind of like, yeah. Daniel Pemberton did not do the same thing for The Dark Crystal. And so it lets your music speak on its own. And I think the thing that I want to say about this is there's incredible reverence for the show, your casting on the film, because you know you have tracks like 50th Anniversary, and then you have this great balance between tracks like Slither that are kind of more hard edge, but then you go to Miyagi-Do, and for every Venomous you have a Bonsai Lesson. So it's mm-hmm. it's I like the flow of the show, and I like what you did with that.
I first of all thank you, and I'm glad you recognize that, and I appreciate that you recognize that, because it was, I think that the biggest thing that we are proud of is that we were able to kind of take all those different styles and put them under one roof. And it was the only way to do it. I think we've seen a few criticisms of it actually. And recently we found this like guy on like a thread, someone sent it to us of him like trashing the Cobra Kai score. And I was like, that's how you truly made it. When someone, random internet man, is trashing your score. Like, honestly, I was like, give me more, feed me. But one of the criticisms that I hear sometimes is that it's all over the place. And my answer to that is, I don't understand how else you would score it. Like the show has tons of characters who come from different backgrounds and have different sides of the story to tell. The whole point of the show is hearing different sides of the story, right? Like the best part of the show is hearing a perspective that you didn't expect to hear, or sympathizing with someone you didn't expect to sympathize with. And that's kind of like season three. Like, I mean, we're feeling for Kreese now a little bit, aren't we? Like he's a fucked up veteran that kind of was, you know, put through a really rough situation. But, you know, we couldn't score Daniel with something like Slither. That doesn't represent him. But one thing that we, I think three seasons in now, is what we have a lot of fun with is kind of interplaying the different genres with the different themes. We have a highly, highly thematic score. Like a lot of characters have score themes. A lot of like kind of special like scenarios have themes, like action themes or like nostalgic themes. And our favorite thing to do is to kind of like play maybe like a Cobra Kai dojo theme on like orchestra, whereas you normally hear it in like a rock ensemble. And that's kind of what we started doing in the last episode of season one in the tournament. And I think we're going to be doing a lot more of that. Can I say a spoiler? Is this like a spoiler podcast?
Yeah, go right ahead.
You know, at the end of season three, if you watched it, season three, you know that it ends with them joining forces. So, you know, season four, I haven't read any of the scripts. I don't know what's going to happen, but I know that they are going to be working together. So like what's the kind of fun we can have with our like palette mixing? There was another part. Oh, I was going to say that it's funny. Did you interview Daniel Pemberton on this show before?
I did. I actually spoke to him last Monday.
Oh, really? So yeah. I love that guy. And we met him in Spain in 2019, we did a live performance of Cobra Kai at this film music festival. I mean, if you watched it, season three, you know that it ends with them joining forces. So, you know, season four, I haven't read any of the scripts. I don't know what's going to happen, but I know that they are going to be working together. So like what's the kind of fun we can have with our like palette mixing? There was another part. Oh, I was going to say that it's funny. Did you interview Daniel Pemberton on this show before?
I did. I actually spoke to him last Monday.
Oh, really? So yeah. I love that guy. And we met him in Spain in 2019. We did a live performance of Cobra Kai at this film music festival.
Oh, cool.
And Leo and I were such fanboys of Spider-Man and, you know, a lot of his other scores. And we got really friendly with him, and he's just such an awesome dude and an amazing composer. And I just like love gushing about him, because like he's such an inspiration for sure. And he texted me about Cobra Kai, and I was like, thanks. Thank you for watching. Thank you. Yeah. Anyway, I just had to say that he's such a good composer. He's so good. Talk about someone who's just like so good at tone, like, and does something unique kind of every score. It's awesome.
Oh yeah. I mean, to go from King Arthur, Legend of the Sword, to Spider-Verse, to the USS Callister, to Trial of Chicago 7. I mean, yeah. I mean, well, I just had an hour with him on Monday, last Monday.
That's amazing.
Take a listen to that podcast.
I will listen. Yeah.
But when you said spoilers, I thought you were going to say the team up at the end, which is, I don't know if you can see what color this is. you know, the think of the end of episode 10.
Oh, yes, yes, yes.
Kreese's new friend who is this color.
There's a certain color of the chrome, right? Mr. Chrome?
Yeah, yeah. Destro, I think.
Yeah, I actually, by the way, we don't know who he was talking to on the phone. I don't know who he was talking to on the phone. I haven't read anything in season. I don't know what's happening in season 4.
Okay.
I don't know yet. I like to watch, they're shooting it soon, but I like to watch it as a viewer. I Leo and I like to go in cold and just kind of watch it.
Well, let me ask you a question. You mentioned all the characters have different themes, and what I noticed about, you know, listening to it, I bought the season 1, the long box.
Oh, the long CD. Box. Cool. Thank you.
And I've been listening to that, and a lot of the tracks, are between 1 and 2 minutes. So is there maybe a sweet spot that you have to get a really impactful song in, say, 50 seconds or a minute 20, and it plays well in this short form narrative versus, working Christoph Beck's world where you have a suite that's maybe 12 minutes?
Yeah. Cobra Kai season 1 is interesting because I think we didn't truly discover the sound until halfway through the season. And it's kind of, there's not a lot of giant moments in season 1. The biggest thing was the end of season 1 is the tournament. And that's kind of where a lot of our meat and potatoes, like score, hearty score cues. You know, we have like a 4 minute kind of the All Valley tournament. That cue is like a four minute one. But a lot of the scenes, were shorter, and I think our most impactful of that would be Quiver, which is about like a little over a minute, but that's when Hawk flips the script, and that's turned into basically our Cobra Kai as a dojo theme, and it's one of our biggest tracks. People love it. It's like our most popular track on streaming services, and it's become really kind of an anthem in the show. And I think what happened post season 1 was that the scope just got so big for the series, and the writers and the creators were thinking in just a much bigger scope in terms of like, there's a lot more fights, there's a lot more kind of like stakes, there's a lot more room for kind of cinematic composing. We record orchestra for every episode now, which we did not do season 1. We only did that for the finale in season 1. But we record orchestra every episode now, so we have that at our disposal. And we like the, and also season 3 now, by the time season 3, it's like our season 1 album is 45 minutes. Our season 3 album is 85 now. And wow. We have a 10 minute track on the album now. So now we're and also, by the way, as of today is Tuesday the 19th, you got your long box from La La Land Records, but La La Land Records just released today seasons 2 and 3 deluxe CDs. So if you're interested in getting the CDs for season 2 and season 3, you can get them now.
Oh, perfect.
But it is like, yeah, it really feels like a different TV show. It's funny because we always say, yeah, it's a quote unquote half hour comedy. Like, there's no way it's a habit. Like, it's scored like a fucking action movie. Like, there's 30 minutes of wall-to-wall John Williams-style score /, like, hair metal Christmas fights on the season finale of Death. Like, it's just a crazy... I am proud to say there's truly nothing else like it on TV, but it is just hilarious that it's a 30-minute comedy, quote unquote, and it's budgeted like a 30-minute comedy. We're always fighting for more money to do orchestra and stuff like that, because it's just not budgeted the same way that like The Mandalorian is budgeted.
Sure. And I was just gonna say, it feels like the kitchen sink approach, which, like you said, that was one of the things I was most impressed by and taken back by. You're looking at the fight choreography that's going in sort of 360 in the finale of season 3, but then you've got the Christmas metal. So who was that, you, Leo, together, like who came up with that, and how did you materialize it?
That was, they told us there was going to be a Christmas fight early on in the series, and I was like, that was, I mean, like, what, okay, like, what does that mean? Like, what does a Christmas fight entail? That's kind of funny, working on this show, they always say, like, there's like X fight, there's a snake pit fight, there's a Christmas fight, there's a mall fight. And we love that. I mean, I remember also just like having, sorry, this is kind of sidebar, but I remember like telling them like, oh man, it's season 3. Like, I have this idea where like Johnny and Daniel are going to like kind of work together to do something, and they're going to get in a scenario where people like are going to fight them, and they go, you don't want to do this. Like, that's like my favorite kind of like trope for like, and they're like, yeah, it's a garage fight. But they said Christmas fight, and there's already kind of a wonderful tradition, thanks to kind of Trans-Siberian Orchestra, of like that Christmas heavy metal influence. So we started with Carol the Bells, like dun 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 dun, because just as an homage to that, but it's public domain. So Christmas, a lot of Christmas music, public domain. And we were like, okay, well, let's have like a Christmas medley a little bit. So we did Carol the Bells, we did Hark the Angel. I'm Jewish, so I was like, I don't quite know what the names of the Christmas songs are. I think it's Hark the Angel on High or whatever. In fact, like when I was working on that, Leo was like, I thought it was all Carol the Bells. And Leo was like, oh, that's cool, you did two Christmas. Like, I didn't know they were different songs. And then we decided to like tie in, there are Cobra Kai themes within that. And we when Tori and Sam kind of face off together, we have a throwback to one of our cues called Hallway Hellscape from season 2, which is when they last fought. So we had a lot of kind of like mini Easter eggs within that cue. And we knew it was just supposed to be fun. Like, our biggest thing is like, we want the score to be self-referential. We want it to be kind of aware of itself. I think that's why the show works too. It takes itself seriously, but it knows that it's having fun. And I think when people recognize that, sometimes people say it's cheesy, but like, I don't see why cheesy is a bad thing. I think people only say it's cheesy because they're like insecure about themselves watching. I was like, no, it's, if you embrace the cheese, then like, it's, you'll have a blast.
Oh, sure. Because I mean, you know, everything's based on Johnny, you know, resurrecting the dojo and having this broken relationship with his son and Allie. And over time it becomes a soap opera. And I was watching us going, cause my wife watches soap operas and I laugh at her, but I go, this is the exact same thing. They found a way to interweave everybody to the point where you wouldn't be surprised if a character was named David. David gets in a coma. Well, we brought his twin brother, Navid. It's like Navid. They found just ways to make it all work. And
I know.
And they even made reference to, I think they mentioned the term soap opera in the show, which I just thought was great. It's great.
Right. And they, because they're so self, they reckon, I love when they, you know, there's a line in the season 1 where they say like, oh, if you didn't, you know, if you don't know, the San Fernando Valley with karate is like Texas with football. Like, there's like this kind of little bit of like world building where it's like you are in a world. And in season 3, when they're at the like council meeting, the LA, the city council meeting, trying to get the tournament back on, and the like council member goes like, what is everyone's obsession with karate in this city? Like, and my girlfriend loves when like Amanda, Daniel's wife on the show, like when she says like, no more karate, like it cracks her up, because it's just like, why is karate? And there's no guns in the whole show, which I love. And it's just like, yeah, just it knows what it is. And it's, I think it goes 100% into the bit, 100%. And they treat it, they love the source material so much. They love it. And I love that they've been able to like milk all the different movies, and they brought back Kumiko and Chosen, all these characters, and who I'm excited to see, you know, will they ever bring back Hilary Swank? That's kind of like the one that I'm like, they've never had Daniel and Hilary Swank have never had an interaction before. Like, what are the really fun things that they can do? And I think they make it, you know, that kind of MCU level universe where like, it's just like all these things and all these characters and their backstories and is everyone connected? Maybe not, but it's awesome.
And it keeps you interested, because, you know, we still don't know who Tori's mom is, but she's in a bedroom that you can't see. Yeah. Was that on purpose?
Right. We don't know anything. Yeah.
You know, I think my favorite part of the show is, maybe I might be digging too deep into it, but in season 3, where they're having the All Valley, they're trying to bring the, I think Daniel's petitioning to bring back All Valley. And he says something, well, I was bullied as a kid. And somebody in the back goes, I heard you were the bully. And I'm thinking, is that the Patton Oswalt connection?
Yes, yeah. I know. And that's actually Josh Heald, who's one of the creators of the show. Okay. That's him yelling.
Okay. Yeah.
It does have, I mean, it's all, yes, it's all this like, yes, it's all like a feedback loop. Like, mm-hmm. they are very aware of the world, mm-hmm. you know, the outside world in which Cobra Kai exists, but that's what makes it so special. And we, with the music, we also, you know, we try to do that too. We're always kind of referencing, you know, whether it's a certain type of score, a certain genre. Season 3 had a lot of kind of like sports movie genre vibes to it. I always like to say it's like, it's that cliche where like in the scene, well, Daniel and Sam walk into the All Valley Arena and the lights are off and he turns on the lights and it goes like boom, 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 boom. And like, you've got that like very sweeping kind of Alan Silvestri like style diatonic score. And it just feels like really kind of like Mighty Ducks core. Like that's what we're all about, is like, we don't live in a vacuum. Like, we are very aware and we love when people recognize that stuff too. Like people hitting us up on Twitter, like, hey, did some of the Okinawa music, was that inspired by Princess Mononoke? It's like, yeah, definitely. Like we are consumers of content and enjoyers of music and culture and film, and we really love that stuff.
Well, so Johnny's a time capsule. I mean, I think nothing was more evidenced than the pack part where he brings the laptop back and says, it's out of juice. He's like, you had to plug it in. He goes, I thought you said it was wireless.
Yeah, so, yeah.
So between you and Leo, who do you gravitate towards more? Who do you have a fondness for? Who do you see yourself in characters?
That's really funny that you asked that. We recently kind of discovered that, I think in another interview, we kind of had pinpointed down that Leo is actually way more Cobra Kai and I am more Miyagi-Do, in the sense that Leo is kind of a brash guy. And he really like wants you to know how he feels. And I'm more of like a people pleaser. And I kind of like to internalize things a little bit more, but it's funny because like I come from a guitar background and a lot of the guitars are either me or arranged by me and played by amazing players. And Leo comes from like a jazz orchestra background. And you know, he sometimes starts off with some of the big sweeping Daniel moments. So it is kind of funny that we ended up kind of handing them off to each other, and some of the best stuff, like with guitars and rhythm section, Leo has put together, and same with orchestra with me. So it kind of changes, but I think in terms of the dojo alignment, that's the way it is, I think. Yeah.
Okay. Do you have a favorite character that you're most interested to see how they kind of manifest or progress?
I love Miguel. I've always loved Miguel. I think Sholo is an amazing actor. I think he's going to be a superstar. Like, I think he's just waiting to get hired to be a superhero in a movie. I mean, he's already ripped. Like, what else do you need?
Sure.
I really love, I think the show is at its best when Johnny and Miguel are together. And I think they're, and season one had a lot of that. And season 3 has a lot of it too. What I really like is seeing favorite characters interacting. I liked seeing Miguel and Daniel interact this season, which is cool. And there's a lot of times you realize like, oh, these characters haven't like talked to each other. I don't know. Yeah. So anytime Miguel is on screen, I just love his character. And I think he's such a good actor.
I agree. And you know, some, even going back to one of their first interactions where he surprises Johnny by saying, you know, have you heard of rat? I was, you know, doing a, yeah. I went down a rabbit hole and Johnny just looks at him like, you know who rat is? Yeah, they're awesome.
A little
rat
smirk.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So
I'm also interested to see, Leo and I have been talking a lot about this recently, that we've kind of like, we're interested to see where Robbie goes, because Robbie is in this like nebulous, like, who do we root for him or do we not root for him? Like, we're constantly changing every season. Like, who do we root for? And I think Robbie is the ultimate redemption arc. Like, will he redeem himself? Like, where he's the one over seasons of seasons, like, what is his journey? Like, he's kind of the lost soul throughout the whole thing. It's not quite Miguel, it's Robbie. So sure. That'll be interesting to see.
So you can't say anything about season 4. You didn't read anything yet. What are you looking forward to musically to maybe contribute, or do you have to wait until you see the dailies and things put together visually?
I think, well, as I had mentioned briefly before, like hinted at that, I think we're going to be doing a lot of this kind of like palette mixing this season. I think we're going to have some fun playing like, you know, Miyagi-Do material on, you know, make it sound like hair metal or something, like something that's going to play the kind of friction between the two of them as they work together for the first time. And, you know, I think like there's going to be some new characters, maybe a new character that was hinted at earlier in this conversation. You know, what are we going to do for him? I'm not quite sure yet. He kind of has a sound. Terry Silver kind of has a sound, like in The Karate Kid 3, there's the like, Vivaldi stuff that kind of plays. It's this like kind of mega evil, kind of almost like this like corporate thing with him. And so, you know, I don't know what we'll do necessarily with that if he comes back. I think the thing that we get nervous about is like, how the fuck do we top the finale of 3? That was just like the biggest, I don't quite know how we're going to go bigger, but maybe we don't go bigger this season. Like, I don't know. We're going to have to wait to see what the outline is, but you know, they always deliver, the showrunners always deliver. So like, if they want to go really big, we will go as big as we can.
And you and Leo work really well together. And then we're excited to hear what that next hump is going to be. But maybe more to, you know, you guys sort of ebb and flow. How do you like to work, or how do you work? Does one of you write, the other you play? Do you, you know because you know different mm-hmm. instruments, how does that speak to your strengths?
We definitely work very well together, and it's very collaborative because we came up under the same systems at Chris's place. So we have the same rigs, we have the same templates, we have the same naming mechanisms, we have the same like queue databases, like, you know, Google Docs, all that stuff. We just kind of that is half the battle. It's just the logistics is just we're under the same umbrella there. And in terms of collaborating, a lot of times we exit a spotting session where you decide where the music is going, you watch it down, you decide where the music's going to go. We exit and we say, maybe I'll say, I've got an idea for this one fight. Let me take a stab at that fight. And, you know, maybe Leo will say, I have some ideas for this kind of arc. So I want to take material that I had worked on last season and start with that. And then what we do is we do a lot of like sending iPhone videos to each other, which I think we're going to have to stop doing now that there's a little more scrutiny on this show. But we're sending iPhone videos of just like, what do you think of this? Like, do you think that this should hit this? We have separate studios. So, and especially during COVID, we're working on our own, but, and we have yet to score Cobra Kai in COVID. So that will be interesting. We finished season 3 about a month before lockdowns.
Wow.
So that'll be interesting. But again, we have the same type of file sharing situation. And yeah, sometimes I'll just say, hey, I worked on this guitar oriented cue, but I'd like you to do a string arrangement that I think you just crush more than me. Or, you know, he plays the iwi, the electronic wind instrument, which is kind of like a MIDI saxophone, like maybe get some iwi on this. And he'll do the same with guitars or bass, or I program drums pretty well. So like maybe he needs some drum programming. And then we have an amazing team that just helps us out. Like we have amazing assistants who prep all the material. They send it to our awesome orchestrator, Vincent Apito, who puts it on paper. We have musicians that play all these tracks live. We have orchestras. We have conductors. We have contractors. It's a big team. We're super grateful that we have mixers and music mixers and engineers that are just, it's an incredible team. So we're very fortunate.
Well, we're fortunate to get the music that you've bestowed upon us. can you think of an episode or maybe some of the discussions you've had with Justin and Hayden to where maybe you feel like you're having too much music? Is it starting to overplay pace itself?
That's a good question. Leo and I are very pro not a lot of music. In fact, I think just philosophically, the more music you put in a show or a movie, the more you're kind of covering up for something else. Music is kind of used, you'll see in a lot. You can kind of always tell if a show is like not great or not confident in itself, if there's a lot of music in it. Because the music is kind of, that's something that your listeners can like, as you watch stuff, just pay attention to how much music there is. If you find that there's a lot of music, it's generally because they're covering up for writing or acting or directing. And sometimes music is the last part of the process, and it's used as a way to potentially fix problem areas or set a tone that the writing couldn't really set a tone. And it's used to kind of cover up some things, kind of like makeup in a way. So sometimes we find that if there's a lot of music in the show or in episodes, we will push back and we'll say, like, what is the music? What is the purpose of the score in this scene? And if there really isn't a purpose, do you need it? And we don't, there have been a few episodes where maybe there was more score than we would like, but I think for the most part, the show is pretty confident in itself that it doesn't need a ton of music. At this point, we have a whole library of kind of like transitional material, like that kind of 10 to 15 second material you play in between scenes. But even that, like we don't love to do it as much as some other TV shows do. And what ends up happening sometimes is editors put in music and then it stays less temp. And, you know, the creators get used to having music there and then they edit around the temp music. So then if you take it out, it's too long without music. So there's a lot of things like that. But I generally come from the camp where less music is better.
Okay. And you know, the reason I ask is you brought up a good point where you're trying to look for areas where maybe you take it out or you don't need it. Because I watched a couple things this year and I've noticed the sort of sense of place when it's not something telling you how to feel or beating you over the head. And I've even noticed in going back to Daniel Pemberton, there's a part in the USS Callister where the music specifically drops off. It's playing and playing. And when one character gets to talking, and yep. it makes an impact just as, you know, as would music's, you know, a swell. So, I mean, it's
right. And scoring under dialogue, I think, like, well, you know, when music drops out, if music's playing and music drops out, it automatically tells the audience to, like, okay, start paying attention here. But when music continues, the audience, I actually think, starts to glaze over. I think people will miss things because you're not, and sometimes, you know, music composers are asked to hit a bunch of stuff, like hit this emotion, hit this face that this person makes. And at that point, you're starting to like, okay, truly, what is the music doing here? And luckily, Cobra Kai doesn't do that, but I've worked on projects where it does, where you do that. And it just kind of cheapens it. I think it really cheapens it. And it does a disservice to what is generally actually most of the time pretty good acting or directing or writing. And it comes from insecurity, I think. And also, I think a lot of the creators are conditioned to have a lot of music in. Maybe a lot of the TV or movies they watch have a lot of music. And so when you watch old movies, and when I say old, I mean even from the 80s, like not that old, but like not everything is score. Karate Kid, it's not caked in score. Like there's plenty of moments of silence. And I think even, you know, the big scene where Pat Morita is like talking about his tragedy, like, I don't even think that's scored. I might be wrong, but you know, you don't need, but it brings a lot of weight to the scene without score.
Well, do you mean that the part where Daniel's reading the Karate Kid, was it one, where he's reading the news article about the,
Miyagi's drunk. And he's drunk, yeah.
Uh-huh. Okay.
I think there's no score. Someone will probably yell at me that there was score, but.
Maybe the same guy who's bashing the score.
Yes, honestly, yeah. he let it be known in that thread that he liked Bill Conti a lot more. It's like, all right, do your thing.
Well, you know, it's so funny. They say there's no such thing as bad, you know, bad press is still good press. Sure. I like to think that if, like, the South Park approach, if South Park is making fun of you, then I think you've made it, because a big enough target that they want to take you down. Just real quick, you mentioned the show is cheesy and it leans into itself. So if you were going to watch this and introduce this to maybe someone new to the show, or, you know, a friend, what cheeseburger from what chain would you just want to, you know, go grab? What would be a good pairing?
Literally, yeah. A cheeseburger.
Yeah, with a Coors Banquet.
I'll tell you that I don't eat red meat anymore, so I do not have the same urging for a cheeseburger as I once did. However, I mean, SoCal, I'm from SoCal, In-N-Out is the best way to go, in my opinion. In fact, I'll still get a fucking grilled cheese from there, because it still tastes like an In-N-Out burger. I guess a Coors Light Banquet. It's funny how Coors Light Banquet has completely embraced Cobra Kai. I keep seeing them doing like these branded posts. It's so funny.
All right. And then I guess the last question. So you've grown up with movies, you've grown up with music that you like. Can you think of a couple, you know, on the same wavelength of cheesy things that you probably grew up going, I know this is not a great movie, but I'm really enjoying it. Do you have two or three recommendations, whether or not the music was, you know, stuck with you as well?
Good question. Okay, I guess one thing that Leo and I talk about, which you probably could hear in Cobra Kai, is we love Power Rangers. Oh, and really? Growing up with the Power Rangers, like, I mean, we were 90s kids, so like, we're not 80s kids, we're 90s kids, and Power Rangers was the thing in the 90s. And, you know, talk about cheesy, like, that is a very cheesy show. But the music, I think, really stuck with us, and even less the music, but more just the general kind of vibe of the music. And you can kind of hear that. And people always say, like, mall fight sounds like Power Rangers. The scene kind of looks like Power Rangers. They're in a mall, they're kind of wearing kind of generic kind of 90s looking outfits, and we love that. Like, we were very aware of that, like, we like to channel that. So definitely Power Rangers. I think, you know, we love anything that kind of, I love, like, Jackie Chan movies. Fun, kind of, like, again, like, self-aware. They probably don't age that well anymore in terms of just content. But, like, I mean, like, Rush Hour is just an amazing, like, I mean, we love Lethal Weapon. Like, those, to end the scores over there are so, we like really kind of early Hans Zimmer scores that are a bit over the top, like anything with, like, an electric guitar that just seems like so, like, are you kidding? It seems very dated. Like, we would love that, like, working on stuff like that. Some of the, you know, Michael Mann movies, and, like, Heat, I don't know, like, those types of things. Tangerine Dream, like, Risky Business, obviously Top Gun, over the top. Like, I want to score stuff like that. I like when scores are very earnest, like, And I think Ernest gets co-opted by cheesiness. And I think people think they're one and the same, but they're not. And they actually are not mutually exclusive at all. Like, you can be Ernest and you can be cheesy. And in fact, like, that's part of the appeal to Cobra Kai and to our music, to our score, is that we fully lean in. It comes from a place of love and not from making fun of. We like to say that comedies, like, every single, if a show runs long enough, there's always a training montage in the show, like a joke, right? There's always sure. Some, like, oh, it's like a minute he's training, we gotta have some, or even in commercials, there's that, like, kind of the training montage became such a parody of itself. And then Cobra Kai comes along and we're actually getting to do a training montage that is actually a training montage from the movie that, like, basically invented the training montage, next to Rocky. Next to Rocky. But, like, what a once in a lifetime experience. Someone said making training montages cool again, which, you know, I appreciate that. Like, it's such a cool thing that we get to do. And it comes from a place of love. I keep saying that, but we really appreciate those styles and really, like, you know, what a culmination for me personally. I like to say that, like, I mean, like, DAD, I think, I don't know if we would have gotten Cobra Kai if it wasn't for DAD. And I, like, people ask me about, am I going to release more DAD music? And to be honest, I don't know, because it kind of, I get that release from Cobra Kai. I get that, I scratch that itch from Cobra Kai, the synthwave itch. And, like, that has kind of become DAD in a way. And it is very rare that you get to work on a show with amazing people that is your voice, that you really feel like is your voice and you're not compromising anything. And it's just a huge success. Like, that just never happens. It's a very rare thing. So we're really lucky to be a part of it. And I just, like, you know, you never know when a show is going to go, like, if it's going to get canceled or whatever. And I know Netflix is notorious sometimes for you know, letting go of a show too early or whatever. But so, you know, we like to treat every kind of season. We know they want to go to 6 seasons. Whether or not it gets there is yet to be seen, but we are just, like, every season, we're just, like, so happy we get to work on stuff like this.
That's great. Well, the next time I see you, if I see both of your arms in casts, I'll know that you broke your arms patting yourselves on the back, which you guys you guys really deserve it. I'll give you a high five when I see you.
Appreciate it. Where are you based, by the way?
I'm in Dallas, Texas.
Oh, cool.
So when the whole like Texas the
oh sure the football
yeah. exactly yeah it makes perfect sense
awesome.
Well, I thoroughly loved every minute speaking to you, and you know, you kind of maybe made the Bandcamp fans a little upset by saying DAD is probably not going to be coming around anytime soon. But in light of that, can you maybe just give our listeners where you're located on the web and ways to search out your music?
Sure. Yeah. I have a website, ZachRobinsonMusic.com. DAD is on every streaming service, as well as Bandcamp. And you can find all the Cobra Kai soundtracks, including, we didn't really talk about it, but the video game soundtrack, which Leo and I did too, which if you also want kind of a synthwave fix, the video game soundtrack is quite the homage to early 90s, late 80s video game music. So if you want to scratch that itch, check out that soundtrack. So we've got all three score soundtracks to the show and the video game on all streaming services. We've got the physical CD releases via La La Land out now, and that's I think all the updates. We're hopefully going to have some more stuff down the pipeline between Leo and I, and I'm doing my own stuff now, working on certain projects that haven't been released yet but are going to come out later this year, so there'll be a lot of stuff.
Well, cool. We hope that we can share when that becomes public knowledge. We hope we can share that with the fans. But until then, keep crane kicking, because anything above the waist is legal.
Absolutely. Always agree with that.
You take care of yourself. Thanks, Zach.
Thanks, Mark.